Welcome to Community Alert. Not if, but when. Positive preparation for disaster with Ted Adams and Mike Williams, keeping you informed on how to get ready and be prepared. Tuesdays at 11 a.m. and 9 p.m. and Saturdays at 1 p.m. on AM 1290, the Santa Barbara News Press radio station.
Hey, folks, welcome to another edition of Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. And today we have with us our old friend, Dr. Glenn Miller, psychiatrist, Santa Barbara, well-renowned gentleman. And I got a lot of interesting insights, and I'm hoping you'll share some of them with us in this hour. Mike.
We're going to have a great conversation. You picked the perfect day to come by because I've been looking for a new car, so my stress levels are in the,
Okay, yeah. Where's the couch, Richard?
I'm also pleased to report that I've checked the date on all of the PSAs to make sure that they're current.
We were making announcements a couple of weeks ago that were actually had happened.
Yeah, they were past tense, you know, so nothing like staying on top of the curve when disaster strikes, you know. Anyway, first coming from a Santa Barbara County Fire Department in the Santa Barbara County Air Pollution Control District, tips for cleaner fireplace burning and safer homes. Don't burn trash. Be a good neighbor and notice your smoke. Save your fireplace or wood stove for special occasions. Try to use gas logs when you can. Have your chimney inspected and cleaned regularly by a professional chimney sweep, and this is extremely important to have done. Never use gasoline, charcoal lighter, or other fuels to light or relight fires because the vapors can explode, flash fires being a pretty common thing with fireplaces. Do not allow small children near fireplaces. Never leave a fire unattended. Make sure no flammable materials hang around or decorate your mantle with flammable materials. And finally, make sure you have a basic fire extinguisher somewhere close by. This and other tips available from the Santa Barbara County Fire Department and the Air Pollution Control District. And I have to confess that I used to be one of those people that thought, what's this? Why do we have the fireplace police? But I've come to realize that there is a big issue with fireplace smoke and how it lingers in neighborhoods. We don't see it so much here in Santa Barbara visually, but it's a big problem. It's a big issue, and there are communities that have passed ordinances outlawing fireplaces.
Ashland, Oregon, for one.
Yeah. I don't think you have to go that far. I believe Berkeley, California, I think some of the Bay Area. And, I mean, certainly we could argue that, but it's a real deal. I've come to accept the fact that we don't know what we don't know, and that's what this show has been very good about, is bringing people in and talking about issues that we might have been...
We know a point that you just made about children and keeping them away from fireplaces. I remember when I was young, and my parents did it to me, and I think that a lot of parents in that age did it, was when the child was old enough to walk, they would take them over to the fireplace and put their hand on it when it was hot.
Yeah,
and I never got close to that fireplace again.
Wow, that's called a guided discovery.
Yeah. Of course, I don't have the use of half my right hand, but
but other than
that would just get you in trouble anyway. And from Santa Barbara County Public Health Department. This is serious stuff here. This is the flu vaccine time of the year. You guys are in here. Every year, flu spreads across the country from person to person, family to family, and community to community. It's time to get your flu shot. For further information, visit the Public Health Department's website at countyofsb.org or visit vaccine.healthmap.org. That's vaccine.healthmap.org for a drugstore here locally that is providing flu shots. Again, this from Santa Barbara Public Health.
And if a senior, you can get those flu shots for free many, many places.
And I've already had the flu. I've already gotten through it, so I don't know.
You tried to give it to the rest of us, too.
I did everything I could to be a good neighbor, and it failed
miserably. Sharing is caring.
That's correct. It depends on what we're sharing, though. We're off to a very bad, rocky start here. Anyway, let's talk.
It all started with that car.
I got to tell you,
I haven't bought a new car in, I don't know, since 2000, and that was a truck, and I bought that on the phone because I was buying a fleet truck. I mean, how much do you have to know to buy a truck? I go start looking for cars, and I cannot believe what a new car is, A, how much they cost, and B, there's nothing mechanical in them anymore except the motor itself. Everything else is electric, and that's everything from the Honda Accord all the way up to this Mercedes S550, the Cadillac, the Lexus, the Impala. I drove all these different cars. They're all electric, and I'm thinking to myself, my God, the connector problems that these cars are going to have and the electrical issues that we're going to have is staggering. And yet I call an engineer friend of mine over at Raytheon, and he says flying-by-wire has been going on for decades now in the aviation industry, and we've mastered connectors.
Well, that's all good until we have an electromagnetic pulse problem from the sun, nothing's going to work.
I mean, what we're driving and flying actually are like oversized laptops on wheels.
Well, yeah. I felt like an old man turning in his horse for his first car. I mean, it was that dramatic of an experience.
I love this car.
I mean, the first thing the guy wants to know is how to take my cell phone and lock it into the dashboard. Now, why do I care? I'm just driving the car around the block. Why do I care about all this? And you've just demonstrated to me why I don't want any of this stuff. Yeah. I mean, what do you need? You need a gas gauge, a speedometer, direction of travel, and that's pretty much
temperature gauge and oil pressure is good.
Yep.
And
well,
a lot of them don't have
those
them
anymore.
They just got
well.
Lights.
I mean, it's like airspeed, altimeter, and you know, what else do you need?
Yeah.
And so, but now you've got cables that plug into your laptop, and you've got Bluetooth to your telephone, and so your whole car becomes this giant tracking device, and your music systems
to make you
all
wonderfully distracted while you're flying and 65 miles an hour down the freeway.
That's exactly right. I get into the Honda Accord was a good example of this. I get into the Honda and I put it in reverse. Now it's not a mechanical reverse. There's nothing. No
right,
talk back
it.
To you. You just touch it. And I'm sure the next step is we're just going to talk to it.
Or think it.
And the car actually, well, the car actually does. You do actually do talk to the car, which I absolutely hate. You talk to this car to tell you. But you put it in reverse, and all of a sudden all these screens pop up with cameras as to what you're getting ready to back into. And then it has a graphic on there as to your turning radius and your stopping distance, and it's how many feet to the wall and all this other stuff.
So there's no more just looking over your shoulder and looking out
well,
the rear view.
No,
rear
and I'm thinking, you know, who's driving the car? No one's driving the car. The car is driving you, which is actually a sales pitch on the Mercedes. The difference between the BMW, which is the ultimate driving machine, the car that you want to drive, which I got in the back lot right now, it's fun to drive as long as the parts don't fall off. The Mercedes, on the other hand, drives you.
Oh.
And this car is incredible. You start drifting off the lane, and it starts vibrating in the seat. The car automatically decelerates and comes to a stop. So if you fall asleep at the wheel or you spilled your coffee or you're talking on the cell phone or whatever else Ted does in the front seat of the car, the car stops. And I'm just thinking, my God, this is amazing. And yet the fail rate, and it gets to what I want to talk about today, and that's risk and normalcy bias and whatever. You're driving a car, and I almost have to relearn how to drive these vehicles because they're all automated now. It's almost more difficult than flying a Cessna.
Oh, yes.
Now, the Cessna is flying in general, because you got radio and you have some other things that you have to be engaged in, so it's a three-dimensional process versus driving you don't. But, yeah, you are absolutely fully involved in the driving process now, and it's amazing. And so we get into that and risk.
Well, and driving system, you're becoming more of a systems manager than actually a driver. Just like a pilot now is more of a systems manager than actual pilotage.
I felt like I was on a laptop with wheels on it.
Yeah.
It's pretty much. And then, in fact, the new Cadillac dashboard is nothing but a giant laptop screen.
Wow.
Which, it looks cool. And then I'm thinking, well, how many hundred hours do you have to sit in a class to learn how to use your car? And it turns out that Mercedes actually has classes for learning how to drive your car, as do some of the other manufacturers. And how long does it take to program this thing? Because you have an option between digital display versus analog display, which is actually digital, but it gives you an analog graphic and those kinds of things. And how long is this going to last before you got to come in and figure out why your engine light's on?
And that's it. Remember the old days when you'd go to Hertz or Avis and you'd rent a car? You knew exactly where the key went. You knew how to roll down your windows, and you drove off. Now I get to the airport, get in the rental car, I'm like, well,
yeah.
How what? Do you turn it on?
Well,
and it won't turn on until you put your seatbelt on or you
it's
do.
It's amazing.
I mean, there's definitely idiot features in there. Like, you cannot start your car until your foot's on the brake. Well,
right.
We know where that came from. And you can't lock the key inside the car. It won't let you do that. Right. I mean, there's certain things in there that are obviously idiot compensation features.
Yes.
Or inattentive compensation features or stuff. I'm surprised they don't have interlocks on them so that you can't drive intoxicated. I suppose that's an option on some of these cars. You can certainly get them at court ordered.
Right.
But I'm just thinking, of course, then how do you put the thing in?
Well, they've got windshield graphics on some of the cars.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah, they have heads up
display.
Yeah.
And it's kind of cool, but it's all stuff that causes your brain to go stop driving and start watching, thinking, interacting,
yeah,
and what have you. And the rear view mirror, the right rear view mirror has displays on them, some of them now. And I'm just thinking, this is all very distracting to me. I mean, it's just now I'm an old time driver. Right. I used to have a GTO. I used to drive International Scout. I mean, these things were pretty much start and crash. Now you can't crash your car unless you make an overt act.
And the younger generation is very skilled at this multi-technological tasking,
mm-hmm.
because they'll be on their computer with their iPhone and have the,
sure.
But I was reading Apple TV going.
I was reading some studies about this, about the multitasking and how they can listen to a lecture and they can type and they can be talking to someone and playing a video game and doing it all at the same time and feeling very comfortable and confident. But they did a bunch of research on that and found out that instead of being adept at all these things, that all those things are diminished, mm-hmm. that everything that you're doing when you're doing that is diminished a certain percentage, and it's not as if you're totally capable in all these areas. It's just that you're doing it and your mind isn't completely engaged.
Speaking of multitasking, it's time to get out of here. We're dealing today with Dr. Glenn Miller, Ted Adams, Mike Williams, Richard Dugan on the board, and the clock on Community Alert. We'll be right back on KCSB AM 1290.
Hey, folks, welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. Today we're visiting with Dr. Glenn Miller, psychiatrist here in Santa Barbara, and we've managed to talk about nothing but fun stuff for the last 15 minutes, and maybe we'll get into something.
We're having way too much fun today, and that is just the diamond lane to disaster. I do want to put in a free plug for the folks over at Santa Barbara Auto Group. Those guys over there and gals have really got their act together. I've bought two cars there in the past, which, of course, the people there now don't know that, but, I mean, I have. Mm-hmm. And they are a first-rate operation. And mm-hmm. I got a little issue going on right now, and they're just being tremendous about it. And you just don't see that anywhere. And when you talk about buying cars, for example, buying local, your instincts, well, I'm going to go to Central California. Everything's cheaper there. I can get a car. I can buy it on the phone. I can buy it online. I can do all those things.
But nobody knows you.
But nobody knows you, and nobody cares. And you don't normally think about auto dealerships caring except for making the sale and getting the paper in the hopper before the end of the month, which I'm sure is true here. But I'm just saying that these guys have really made an extra effort, and I want to put that out there for those that are listening that there is some help out there. Let's get into what I wanted to talk about was risk management, normalcy bias, and I think what sparked that was an article that I wrote it's been a month and a half ago, on normalcy bias as it relates to fire and police and public safety.
Talk to us a little about what normalcy bias is.
What it gets down to, and correct me if I'm wrong from the medical point of view, but we do, for people that are in high-risk occupations, whatever they may be, flying, law enforcement, taxi drivers, high-rise construction, whatever it may be, you do it every day. You do it day in and day out. You may push your luck from time to time. Certainly cops and firemen do that. You may step into the outside of the safety comfort zone, but you get away with it, and you get away with it day after day after day, and the people you work with get away with it day after day. And yes, you know instinctively from your training and from your readings and what have you that it's dangerous, but it has never happened to me. And as a result, we tend to get a little loose, we get a little sloppy, and we start pushing the envelope of what we probably should be doing common sense-wise, particularly as we get a little older. Our brains are telling us we're 21 years old, we're still on the training ground, we still can do hoorah and all of that. Unfortunately, at 55, the body is in disagreement with that. And suddenly,
to be 55 again.
Oh. Yeah, indeed.
You're interrupting the flow.
I'm sorry, sorry.
Yeah, talking about multitasking.
Too much fun.
Yeah, but you get where I'm going with that, normalcy bias. And then the article came out, and what was interesting and why I contacted you about it was I received a phone call from a national fire chief the day after the Yarnell fire because my article on normalcy bias was republished in a fire magazine on a national level. Mm. And so he called me up, and he wanted to know what I thought about that and if there was any factor within the Yarnell fire, because these guys were in a very safe location, and that's now been validated through the investigation. I didn't know that at the time. And I go, well, I think there has to be a factor to that. I think another factor that plays into that, which is what my next article this week's about, is technology, the over-reliance on technology, whether it be radios and GPS and dashboards and cars. Yeah. And so that got me to call you about risky behavior that people do. And training is certainly mitigate. We mitigate our risk, and so that things, it gives us a false sense of security. So that's what I wanted to talk about today.
Well, it's interesting, too, is that just to add on to the whole construct of normalcy bias, is that a negative event, or if you would, an event that actually we experience that plays against our normalcy bias, oftentimes only temporarily disrupts it. Mm-hmm. So follow me along on this. So you have a baseline normalcy bias because, as you pointed out, you've done it, not only you, but your cohorts, your colleagues have been doing it, quote unquote, safely for years. And no one's really gotten hurt doing whatever that risk behavior is. So it's the example of jumping horses. Okay, that's pretty risky, jumping horses. So you have people that have been jumping since they were toddlers. They got on horses when they were little, and they, you know, and jumping and jumping. And now they're a teenager, and they get thrown off the horse. Really, you know, I mean, they get really thrown. Okay, and they get bruised and battered, but they nothing permanent. What is it that we as society tell that teenager to do?
Get back on the horse.
Bingo. And they get back on the horse, and all of a sudden, it's working well again. No, you know, after a week, 2 weeks, a month, 2 months, and quickly that baseline normalcy bias is reestablished, even though they just had a
experience.
That challenges that whole belief system. It is quickly adapted once again.
Well, I'd like to just address that situation. I think it goes into getting prepared for disaster. Because people haven't ever had a disaster affect them. They read about disasters in other people, but they get this normalcy bias because they feel as if they're not. It's not going to happen to them. The same thing, I think, happens with drinking drivers. I think people get in the car after having, we've talked about this beforehand, but having too many martinis or whatever. They've never had an accident. Their friends all drink and drive. Why wouldn't they get in the car and drink and drive? And then something happens that forces them to make a decision that they're incapable of making or a movement that they can't make because of what's happened to them with the drinking, and they're in trouble. And I think that we see this bias through in all these things because we get used to certain behavior and certain things happening to us. And until we get that lesson, you know, we're stuck in that.
Well, and what happens with normalcy bias can create very delusional thinking. I mean, if you step back and really think about it, is that highly trained pilots with tens of thousands of hours, something will be going wrong, and they will go, that instrument's lying to me.
Well, they've had crashes where light bulbs, they were dinking with the light bulbs.
Right. And because so often it's always worked out, that they, even though in the face of, we have a problem, Houston, they're going, well, it can't really be that big of a problem because it's never really been that big of a problem. So actually, you not only just have this belief that it'll be okay, in the face of data that's clearly telling you the opposite, you actually negate it. You have it's
right.
Your desire is to, that isn't really true.
I've been just reading about this pilot that took off at the wrong time because of, and crashed into another plane, and he just didn't pay attention to the tower, and he just figured he could do it, and he just went for it, and he killed 500 people or something because of it, because he took out all.
I'm curious as we
and
talk.
He was an efficiency. He was a safety expert with the airlines, and he still just. Ignore it
well,
all.
It's the complacency of it all. But when we talk about this, I see two distinct applications. One's the public safety guy, policemen, firemen, what have you, people who do risky things every day. Guy works for Edison Company. That's also very
absolutely.
But what about risky behaviors such as drinking, smoking, shooting heroin, sexual behaviors, gambling? I mean, all of those human characteristics that, now granted, some of those have addiction factors put into it. But there's a lot of things that people do that are also risky that they get away with for extended periods of time. Is there a difference, or is it still the brain lying to us?
It's actually quite similar. It's the brain lying to us. The source of that lying can be different. In some, like in sociopathic behavior, where they know it's wrong, and it's wrong for everyone else, but I would never get caught because I'm so special. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit different, but it's that still that same kind of delusional thought process that it can't happen to me. And when we get back from the break, it's important for us to discuss why it is human nature to think that it can't happen to me. Oh, that tornado, even though I live in Oklahoma, that can't happen in my house.
Right. Because okay. Yeah, it never has happened.
Yeah, the hurricane that happened. You know, well, yeah, it took out the town next to us out here in Florida, but, you know, that
never
that
happened
happen
to us.
Right.
We're up to our next break, visiting today with Dr. Glenn Miller, Ted Adams, Mike Williams on Community Alert, sponsored by the California Fire Safe Council. Not if, but when. Positive preparation for disaster. Live on the internet at newspress.com on KZSB AM 1290, your Santa Barbara News Press Radio. We'll be right back.
Hey, folks, welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams, and today we're visiting with Dr. Glenn Miller, psychiatrist here in Santa Barbara, and it's always good to have you on the show. A lively show. It always flies by, and I'll be surprised if we actually get to any content this time because we get so diverted by talking about all this interesting stuff.
Training is a big component of what we talk about a lot, training and orientation and mm-hmm. what have you. How do we build a training system for public safety, for example? Like firefighting, for two things that come to my mind as being extremely dangerous is ventilation on a roof. Guys falling through roofs is not mm-hmm. uncommon. And or falling through subfloors. You don't see mm-hmm. that quite as much here because we don't have basements, but that's a big deal. Law enforcement pursuits are a big thing. Standing in front of doors, making contacts and domestic. So there's certain activities that are relevant. How do we build a training system for folks like this, military too, that incorporates the fact that just because you've done this for 10 years and nothing's happened to you, but it has happened to everybody around you, so you're not immune to the fact that it can happen. How do we train people to overcome this?
Well, you know, that's a very challenging question.
Yeah.
It somewhat works at odds against each other. So, for instance, and we can take... Let's take firefighter, just as an example. But it could be the military, it could be the police, it could be any high-risk type of job. What we do to help mitigate that risk is to train.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So on the job, they're training. And then they get called to the fire. They're getting more training, actually hands-on if you were training. And when they're not actually attending to a fire, what are they doing? They're training. And the old joke is that when they're finally done training, what do?
Train.
They train. Okay. And as you train more and more, you do mitigate, to some extent, the risk. You don't eliminate it, you mitigate it. Okay? But all of that training further reinforces the normalcy bias, which we were just discussing, mm-hmm. because it gives you a sense of mastery of that behavior, of that fire. Okay, I've trained so much, and I continue to train so much, it can't ever really get me because I'm in control of it. Okay. So now you have that mastery, and that's what allows you as an individual firefighter, as a fire strike team, to go into high-risk places to begin with. Because if you didn't have that sense
of... That's what happened to the Yarnell fire,
yes,
obviously.
If you didn't have that sense of confidence, you'd never go in. So your question is, how do we train them but yet keep them safe? That's a tough one because the powers that be, whether that's the fire commander and stuff, needs to be able to say to his troops, firefighters, we need you over there. And you look over there and there's 80-foot flames. You need that sense of normalcy bias in order to have the ability to actually go into that environment and do what you've been trained to do.
How does the medical community deal with this? The medical community, unlike a lot of other professions, is pretty good about keeping its door closed. People don't really know what really goes on in hospitals and operating theaters and stuff. If they mm-hmm. did, they would probably not go to them. But be that as it may, but the medical community has the same thing. You've got a surgeon or an anesthesiologist or neurologist or any of these people that are touching people day in and day out that make critical decisions on behalf of their patients are getting caught up in this too, I should think. And they're also driven a lot by equipment and technology, which suggests that they're not going to necessarily fall back on experience as much as they're going to fall back on what the computer pronounce telling them.
Yeah, those are two very both excellent points because technology really is – in a sense, taking over medicine and the art of healing. I think that might be a whole nother discussion.
I would have to be.
Yeah,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
But the idea of normalcy bias, you know, in medicine, rarely is the actual individual medical practitioner's life at risk in that type of thing. What is at risk is your patient's life. Okay? Mm-hmm. And yet normalcy bias can happen in the surgical field. It can happen in the psychiatric field. Like, well, you know, I've not had a patient suicide. Okay. You know, 30 years of practice, knock on wood, I haven't had a patient suicide, yet I have to remind myself every day when I hear a patient talking about potentially taking their own life, that it can happen. Mm-hmm. Just because it hasn't happened yet doesn't mean it can't. The surgeon, just because I've had all these successful surgeries without post-operative complications, doesn't mean that this next patient on the table can't. And that's why, and oftentimes in healthcare, we have multiple redundant systems. We have the physician, then we have the nurse, and we have the pharmacist, and we have the ward clerk, and there's these systems that are kind of mm-hmm. backing each other up, somewhat, if you would, mildly overlapping. Not completely, but overlap in each area so that we have, if you would, redundancy to try and make sure that that one, quote, doesn't fall through the cracks, and yet it,
but
it does.
One area that, I mean, this is a digression, and I'd be interested to hear your take on it, but one of the areas that does not particularly have that kind of check is the medications from Big Pharma for psychiatric problems, like so-called psych drugs. And there's a lot of experimentation that goes on there because it's very difficult to be able to assess what a patient's mind is doing. And so from what I understand and what I'm reading is that they will try different things on patients to see how that works for them, and then adjust the either adjust a particular medication or adjust the amount of medication for their particular problem, and hopefully being able to make that all work for them. But it seems to me that you're flying blind in the fog in a lot of that. I mean, you've got some ideas and you've got some history.
Yes, probably more so in psychiatry than any other field, mm-hmm. and that's because psychiatry, and to some extent neurology when it comes to the brain disorders like seizure disorders and other kinds of things, it's the one main organ system in the body that is protected by a 3/8 to a 1/2-inch shell called our skull. Okay? Mm-hmm. So we can, and we have over the centuries, opened up bodies and watched them functioning. There's a heart beating right in front of me. You could put your hand on it. You can operate on it. It's working. Okay. Mm-hmm. People are loathed, understandably, to be cutting open the skull cap and placing probes and finding out what does this do, what does that do. Okay? So we don't have the ability, and we now with MRIs and PET scans, we're starting to acquire some of it, but we don't have the knowledge base because we aren't able to quote unquote experiment or investigate mm-hmm. on the brain. And when we talk about brain function other than normal physiologic function, like keeping our heart going and breathing right. and releasing hormones.
The difference between the brain function and the mind.
Exactly. When it comes to the mind function, it is so individual, which is what, to be very honest, what I love about psychiatry. Mm-hmm. I can have a dozen patients come through the door, all with the same diagnosis, and every one of them be a completely different story. You walk into your primary care doctor and you've got pneumonia, he's going to give you antibiotic A. And everyone's going to get A, and then those few where A doesn't work, he'll give you B. In psychiatry, it's very different, which it's interesting. Internal medicine, you know, where you have to know a lot about the entire body, is a 3-year residency. Psychiatry is an additional year. It's 4 years. And yet we're only focusing on one small area of the body. And that's because, like with surgery, you're creating an art form, not just a knowledge base, like in most of medicine. Mm-hmm. And it's that art form which makes the surgeon, which makes the psychiatrist better and better as we do it more and more.
Interesting.
Now, this stuff is fascinating because it's why do people do what they do or not do what they should do or any variations of all of that. And when we look at disasters and emergencies, flight versus staying and sheltering and placing, when we come back, I want to talk to you a little bit about something we talked about several months ago, and that is why people don't want to leave something that's obviously a threat to their life. What is it that's going on in their brain that's overriding what their brain's telling them instinctively to do, and they're overriding it, saying, I'm going to stay because whatever the reason. With that, we'll be back in just a minute. Ted Adams, Mike Williams visiting today with Dr. Glenn Miller on Community Alert on KZSB AM 1290.
Hey, folks, one more time. Welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. Today we're visiting with Dr. Glenn Miller, psychiatrist here in Santa Barbara, and having some fun and learning some stuff. Thanks, Glenn, for coming in and being with us today.
Pleasure.
Mike.
I forgot what my other question was going to
be.
Okay,
well, then we're moving right along.
Well, you know, we're having this show between the shows, and you know, right. we're already two chapters down the road. We were talking about behaviors and stuff, and two things that came to mind was the individual who games his income tax, that he's got his TurboTax or his QuickBooks or whatever, and he's gaming the system because he thinks he can understand the program, and he's ahead of the curve, and he's read his books and his manuals and whatever, and he thinks he knows the formula. And the other would be like a shoplifter, the person that's just shoplifting for the purposes of shoplifting. It never gets caught. Both of these people doing very risky things that have significant impact on them if they get caught, and yet they're doing it anyway because you tend to not get caught doing these things.
Right. Well, and part of it, we know that some of these type of behaviors actually trigger pleasure areas of the brain very similar to gambling. I mean, if you think about it,
right.
gambling money.
Because you won.
Because you did. You got away with it. Mm-hmm. You went into the casino. You went into the store and shoplifted. You've done it 40 times, 50 times. First, it's a candy bar, and then it's a pair of socks, and then it's this, and it keeps going up higher and higher because if you would, like a drug, you've got to keep increasing the dose to get the same yayas, right?
Well, it's the adrenaline.
In a sense, it's the adrenaline, but there's actually other areas of the brain that light up. The physical part of it's the adrenaline, that kind of invigorating rush kind of thing. But mentally, what's triggering that, there are pleasure centers in the brain that actually light up on scans when people, we have monitor and are able to investigate that stuff. And so like with the gambler who goes in and actually, win, I mean, the worst, I tell people, the worst thing can happen is the first time you go to Vegas is you win.
Yeah.
It's the worst thing that could ever happen to you because that is your primacy learning experience. And you know, it's always harder to unlearn something than it is to learn something new. So the fact that you win, the fact that you win at shoplifting, the fact that you get away with that on your taxes the first time, and then the second, and then the fifth, and the tenth, and the twelfth, further supports the whole concept that you can get away with this. And in order to kind of get that next level, or to actually maintain the level of high with that risky behavior, you have to actually, excuse my pun with the gambling, you have to up the ante. Okay?
Right.
You have to now you're not stealing a candy bar and then socks and then a shirt and then a $200 dress. Now you're looking at swiping a $500 watch out of the cabinet. And now it's up and up and up. And there is a part of you that knows, just like with the drug addict, that sooner or later this can come down crashing around you. But the high from it is so seducing and in a sense so addicting that oftentimes you've gotten past that. It's a slippery slope. You've gotten past that point of no return, and it will take you down until someone or life stops you.
Well, getting back to the training stuff, because I think that's an area that we all can benefit from, and I remember now what I was going to ask is why do we have a fire coming over the hill, Mission Canyon. It's coming over the hill, 70-mile-an-hour winds, helicopters overhead, get out, get out, get out. There's cars backing up, and somehow, for some reason, you're saying, I'm going to stay, I can take care of this.
Mm-hmm.
Why are people like that? Knowing, I mean, the body's instincts are telling you to leave. Common sense is telling you to leave, but your ego or whatever is telling you, I got to stay.
Well, there's a lot of reasons for that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Ted. There are so many reasons for that. You know, for some, it might be that, you know, all of your worldly possessions. Not
right.
that, not
I can understand that.
It's
sure.
Granted, I'll give everyone, it's just stuff. But everything, the memory, I mean, it's not just stuff. It's
the
not
truth
just
is,
stuff.
Yeah.
It has, you know, it's like, well,
it's your identity.
It's not your house. It's not like, oh, I stayed and saved my house. No, I stayed and saved my home.
It's your collection. It's your life. It's your
and
whatever.
It's your memories, and it's your you know.
Your identity.
So there's a lot that does that, and you know the old saying is that certain people are cut from a different cloth, and not one's better or one's worse. Yeah. It's just different.
Ted and I look like quilts.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the person that knows they don't have adequate insurance and they know that there's not enough firefighters to be at their house or because your house is remote or whatever. And I mean, there's all sorts of reasons to mm-hmm. stay with your home when a fire is approaching. You may have done some preparation. You may have had some experience with fires. And there's a desperate aspect of it too, to protect your belongings and things that you know that you're going to lose.
I'll just speak on and on. And not just as a psychiatrist, but personally, because I did stay during the Jesus Cedar fire,
mm-hmm.
and it did come all around us. And I know that the only reason I stayed was because I lived on a small ranch at the time, and the irrigation system, which is the only water supply, was a very archaic, intricate thing where you had to move valves and turn this one off before you turn these two on and stuff. And had I not done so, the strike team that came and ultimately saved the home would have had no access to
water.
No water whatsoever. Yeah. So I know that's a unique case, but just to show that there's so many reasons why someone.
Exactly.
Now, would I ever do that again after that experience? Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
And why not?
Because it got to one point where there was great confidence amongst the strike team, and the Culver City strike team was unbelievable what these guys did. They were structure specialists, and so they really knew what they were doing. But when that fire turned on us, and they looked at me, and all of a sudden now we're bringing the emergency life support gear into the kitchen because we're going to have to tent ourselves over while the fire passes over. I mean, I'm hearing the plan is we're going to tent over, the fire passes over, we get out, and we fight it from behind.
And unfortunately, Dr. Miller, we don't have a tent for you.
Well, all I know is that when that happened, and, you know, thank God we got a drop right before we had to duck under the tents, I was in that same place that we've been talking about, guys. I was there. I was like, well, this can't really be happening. Yeah, I've watched this fire come through, and I've watched that fire come through, and this one's far away. And if you remember in the Jesus Cedar, we had the firestorm, and then the next day another one.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured that first one came through, survived that. So we're golden now, and we hadn't seen anything yet. And the reason I wouldn't do it again is because I had a wake-up call and realized that we all could have died there. And I wasn't sure if it was just me because I'm a civilian. I don't know firefighting.
Right.
But, sorry, this is kind of a hard. It brings back some memories that are challenging. So about 4 months after the fire, I had, because my family had been evacuated for the week, I had the fire crew come back from Culver City, and we had a barbecue. And I wanted first of all, mm-hmm. my family be able to thank the men that saved their home and saved me. And, you know, and just for them to be able to come bring their families and show them what they do during these things. And we're sitting in the kitchen, and one of the wives of the engineer, I was talking about how when we had da-da-da-da, and I said, you know, and to be honest with you, I thought we were, and she finished my sentence. She goes, you thought you were going to die. And I said, yeah, how did you know that? And she said, because my husband said the same thing. And that's when I really got the chill down my back, because I realized that the trained professionals thought we were up to our eyeballs. Yeah. So that's why I can tell you that life experience for me is telling me that I will never do that again.
And that's consistent.
I don't know how we got there, but
consistent statement with what we've heard from other people that stayed, most of whom were fire professionals, retired Forest Service and county and what have you, that stayed thinking, well, this is just another one of those fires. The Hastings Cedar Fire was not just another one of those fires.
No.
And it caught a lot of people by surprise for a variety of different reasons. And so when we come back, we're going to be limited time. So I'd come back to the issue of training. How do we slow ourselves down to allow ourselves to process information more accurately so that we don't get ourselves in these normalcy bias traps as easily? Mm-hmm. We're going to do that when we come back with Dr. Glenn Miller, Ted Adams, Mike Williams. Community Alert by the California Fire Safe Council on KZSB AM 1290 and live on the internet at newspress.com. We'll be back after this.
Hey, folks, welcome back to Community Alert. This is our last segment. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. Today we're visiting with Dr. Glenn Miller. And, boy, has it been a fast hour.
It flies.
Wow.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Flies.
So, Mike, you wanted to talk a little bit about training for some of these things.
Well, yeah, to me, the training process, I mean, I don't know how many people listening have been in military and police and fire-type training environments, but it's done under stressful environments on purpose to get you to learn how to think and react and do things and perform well under stressful environments, which includes a lot of yelling and screaming and people with stopwatches. And in the bottom line, though, is I think that cultivates an unsafe environment, because it gets you going to the point that everything's based on how quickly you get something done. How fast can you get into your turnout gear? How fast can you do this? How fast can you do that? How many mistakes do you make in the process? Aviation probably has similar types mm-hmm. of things. Certainly how to evacuate an airplane. But if all I'm doing is focusing on trying to get everything on in 90 seconds, or everything I'm doing is predicated on a clock, that means I'm not thinking, I'm reacting.
And that's exceptionally good point. And I talk about this with my patients oftentimes too, and it sounds semantic, but it really is different. I always want to be responsive. I don't ever want to be reactive. Okay? Because reactive, and we train to be so it becomes, as you said, we train and train and train so it's second nature. It's a reaction. You don't have to think. That's what we're taught, right?
Right.
Well, when you sell someone, you don't have to think. That means that you are not necessarily able to ingest, digest, and respond to any nuanced change of information you haven't trained for.
The okay? best example I can think of is shootings, law enforcement shootings. Guy presents a knife, guy presents a gun, whatever, you immediately go into your training, boom, 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 incident's over before the dust even settles, then you start to figure out what's going on. And you certainly have to be able to react that way. I'm not suggesting mm-hmm. we don't do that. But the problem is not everybody that gets shot should have been shot as a result. And that's just the truth. And that's because you're reacting, you're responding to the threat, which is a legitimate threat by all definition. But is it really a threat?
Well, depending. I mean, the guy takes out his cell phone and gets 8 rounds in his chest because the guy saw him reach inside and pull something out.
And he was trained to react that way.
And that's why they don't prosecute these guys because of that.
But again, the problem, and I'm not sure how one solves the problem, but we train people to react. But a reaction does not allow for any slight nuanced variation of the data that's coming in to the person. Okay, so your example, Ted, so a guy reaches in and pulls something dark out of his vest pocket. Okay, well, the 100, 200, 1,000 times that police officer has experienced in training someone reaching in and pulling something dark out of their vest, it was an appropriate kill.
Correct.
Okay, so he did it now number 1,001. And it was a cell phone.
And the Monday morning quarterbacking won't leave you alone for 5 years. I mean,
the rest of your life. I mean, if you've got any
and
conscience.
There's nobody wants to be involved in one of those kinds
of
scenarios.
Of course.
And so how can we help prevent it?
It's really focusing on the nuance of the difference between reacting and responding. And there's a very fine line, especially in the line of work that we're talking about in this example, because milliseconds, let alone seconds,
matter.
May be the difference. They really do matter.
It matters.
Okay? But whenever possible, to really give the sense of respond to a situation instead of react to a situation. I think firefighter maybe isn't quite as critical in the microsecond world, where they really could talk about responding instead of reacting.
Yeah, but that's where experience really comes in, because an experienced fire captain or chief officer can see scenarios and environments changing quickly.
As they unfold. Yeah.
And say, wait a minute, you got to get off the roof. You got to get out of here. You got to back your truck. I mean, those are the kinds of that's experience talking to you.
It's experience.
And experience, when Richard Dugan starts playing with his ears, is that it's time to go. So
is that what he was doing?
It's time. We're off to arts and letters. Thank you very much for listening. And, Doctor, thank you for taking
pleasure.
Time out
great
to be
here
with us.
Again.
Ted Adams, Mike Williams, Richard Dugan on the clock for us on Community Alert, Not If But When, Positive Preparation for Disaster. Live on the internet at newspress.com. If you ever have any questions about what we're doing on the show, give us a call at 564-1290, 564-1290, or 964-7194, and we'd love to hear from you. Until next week, we'll see you. This is sponsored by the California Fire Safe Council. See you next week.
This has been Community Alert, Not If, But When. Positive preparation for disaster with Ted Adams and Mike Williams. Community Alert is produced by the Wildland Residents Association, San Marcos Pass Volunteer Fire Department, and sponsored by the California Fire Safe Council. Technical support for Community Alert provided by Richard Dugan and Jim Williams. Community Alert, Not If, But When. On KZSB AM 1290, your News Press radio station.